shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Daytime turns me off and I don't need maybe. 9 to 5 ain't it taking me where I'm bound. When it's done, I run out to see my baby.
Ro, what night is it? Is it Friday night or Saturday night?
I think it's Friday.
Yeah, we got a special Friday night version of the Nocturnal Journal. Thanks for joining us. 2 hours. In the next hour, we're going to talk about White Sox parks. Amazing vendors. I bet you guys are all White Sox fans.
You bet.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about the history of the old Comiskey vendors a lot. We're going to talk about Go RVing and small houses, tiny houses. In the studio for the first segment, and thank you all you guys for coming down tonight. We're going to pay tribute. I only met her a couple times when I did a story on her, but Wanda Kurek, the proprietor of Stanley's, 43rd and Ashland in Back of the Yards. And she passed away June 18th, right, at age 95. So we want to talk about the history of the tavern. In the studio, we have, why don't you guys just introduce yourself, and we'll start with the Back of the Yards and go specific. But
hi.
Dominic?
I'm Dominic Pasiga, from Emeritus Professor at Columbia College.
And you wrote, which we'll reference here, Slaughterhouse,
right.
Chicago Union Stockyard and the World It Made. Mm-hmm. University of Chicago Press?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Walter?
I'm Walt Kurek, and I'm proud to say that I'm Wanda's nephew.
Okay.
My name is Ken Motti. They jokingly refer to me as the mayor of rockabilly in the music scene in Chicago, and I was lucky enough to be introduced to Stanley's Bar by the young man sitting next to me.
And I'm Steve Mandel. A fan of all things old about Chicago. And
that's why you're on this show. This is your second visit to see
yes.
us. We talked about the Buck of the Sun. So let's just talk about, like I said in the general, let's talk about the history of the Union Stockyard, Dominic, and you know, the ebbs and flows, how it started, how it wound down when Wanda was there. I want to tell the listeners how important it was and how, you know, Wanda's Bar played into it.
Sure. The Union Stockyard opened on Christmas Day, 1865. What better way to celebrate Christ's birthday but to open a livestock market? And it lasted till the first non-market day was August 1st, 1971. So almost 106 years. And it started almost immediately as a tourist attraction and as a center of the meat and packing industry. Most of the packers had been located in Bridgeport along the south branch of the river, but by 1870-75, they began to move in west of the stockyards. And as they moved in west of the stockyards, they filled in the area up to Ashland Avenue. So it was the square mile that people talked about. Tom Wilson, who owned Wilson Meatpacking, who I understand was a customer at Stanley's periodically, he would refer to the square mile almost in a loving kind of way.
Yeah.
He made his fortune there. He ran Nelson Morris Company, and then he owned Wilson Meatpacking. It peaked at World War One. There were about 50,000 people working in the stockyards at the time. And then in the 1920s, it slowly went into decline in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. It peaked again during World War II, but after World War II, you could see a precipitous decline. From 1893 to 1933, there were never fewer than 13 million head of livestock a year in the stockyards. Twice it peaked at over 18 million. So the Tribune called it organized chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you didn't know where you were going, you got lost in the pens real easily.
Yeah.
After the war, the truck and the interstate system
sure.
began to have an impact, and the packers began to buy more and more direct from farmers, and so the stockyards went into decline. So I worked there from 1969 to 1971. And at that point, even that last year, I believe we had 750,000 head of livestock.
What'd you do there?
I was a livestock handler mm-hmm. and then later a security guard.
A security guard?
Yeah.
My dad worked there. He began his career at Swift & Company there, and he was like a messenger boy. This had to be like in the 30s. And mm-hmm. But anyway, you always talked about how it was a city within a city.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
They had a radio station. And
oh, yeah.
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 Did they have a newspaper? And,
they had the Drover's Journal.
Yeah.
Drover's Journal was published there. They had restaurants. They had a hotel, of course, the Stockyard Inn.
Yeah, right.
Before that, known as the Transit House. WGN broadcast the farm report at noon mm-hmm. from the auditorium of the Livestock Exchange building. Yeah, we had at one point there were 100 security guards for the stockyards. The livestock market itself, not counting the packing houses, covered 475 acres. You had a hog house at one point could hold over 200,000 hogs, a sheep house that could hold 100,000 sheep, and the cattle pens just seemed to go on forever.
Built in a kind of a swamp. I mean, everybody talks about, we talked about this with Wanda once, and my dad used to talk about just the smell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, describe the smell.
Oh, well, the smell. You know, I grew up with the smell. I grew up at 46th and Wood Street, it didn't mean anything to me. It was the way everything smelled. But one time when I was an altar boy at Sacred Heart Parish, where Wanda was a parishioner as well, and they took us out to a seminary someplace and out in the country. And I said, what is that smell? It's terrible. What is that smell? It was fresh air. And I got sick.
So Walter, talk a little bit about the history of the bar. I mean, it goes back. The first location was like 1924.
Yeah. My grandfather was the classic American immigrant. I think the story of Wanda and the saloon is pretty much the American story. He worked in the stockyards in Chicago. Actually, was a foreman. He started his first location in 1924. Located approximately 41st and Ashland in a rented location. And basically it was beer and alcohol, and food was really given away as an inducement for customers to come in and stop by. And then as years gone by, the food became a bigger component of the business. But basically my grandfather and my grandmother started with nothing, rented a location, then a second location on 1615 West 43rd Street, right on the alley. That's still a saloon today. Then they moved to 43rd in Ashland on the south side of the street, which is now a Dunkin' Donuts. They saved their money and purchased the corner property on 43rd in Ashland on the northwest corner, mm-hmm. and moved into that location in 1935. And it was always a family business. Everyone in the family worked in the business. My father was a lawyer, but he tended bar. My aunts tended bar. My uncle tended bar. I tended bar when I was in college, and just a family business.
How did you see the neighborhood change? I don't know how old are you?
I am 64 years old.
64 years old. So how did you see, when you go there to work, how did you see the neighborhood?
Well, my recollection of the stockyards when I was a child were basically the animal pens and mm-hmm. many of the buildings, darlings, and so forth, but fairly dormant. All the pens were empty. And then over the course of time, that's changed into an industrial park. And, the neighborhood has changed. It's just a different community today, same type of community, hardworking family people. Life goes on.
And how many people from the family work there?
Well, Wanda had four siblings. So all five of the children worked in the business. I've worked in the business on the next generation. I have a cousin who's also worked in the business, and I have a sister who's worked in the business as well. So I guess that would be a total of eight of us.
Okay, we're going to take a break here, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to talk about Wanda a little bit more specifically in the next generation. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Świeci miesiąc, świeci, tak, ale nie każdemu, tylko temu łopcu, tylko temu.
Marian Lush. Wanda told me she liked Marian Lush. That's why I played that.
Thanks.
Is that, that's on the jukebox there, right?
It is.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys, Ken and Steve, I want to talk about the next generation. How did you guys find it? There's a lot of... Well, that's my next question. A lot of bars that get a rebirth with another generation. I don't know if that's happening at Stanley's, but how'd you guys find the place?
Well, I found it through, a mutual friend of ours, Joe Brill, who grew up in the neighborhood. And we have a fascination with all kinds of disappearing Chicago, old bars and restaurants that are going away, that you're not going to be able to replace, like Marie's Riptide Lounge, yeah, and Bucket of Suds, and some of these, you know, neighborhood bars are just disappearing in Chicago. And Joe and I used to hang out at a bar called Bucket of Suds years ago, and he had mentioned about 5 or 6 years ago, asked if I'd ever been to Stanley's. And he said, Wanda's going to be 90 years old, you know, you should go down there and check it out. And I went down there for the first time for lunch. I got the Polish plate. The food was excellent. Wanda couldn't have been nicer and more friendly. And I just fell in love with the place.
So then you bring Ken?
I brought Ken.
So then Ken, Steve brings you there.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I was not the first member of my family to end up in the back of the yards in that neighborhood. I'm originally from southeastern Iowa, just like my dad, my grandfather, everybody. We're all farmers. In 1937, when my father was 19 years old, he came with a load of livestock from southeastern Iowa to the stockyards and wandered through that neighborhood. And he was proud of the fact that he was there for like a day and a half, spent a total of $2.
Yeah.
He actually went up and saw Jim Poole broadcast from the stockyards, and he went to the Stockyards Inn. So years later, Steve, who has always been my entertainment and nightlife guru since I moved to Chicago in the mid-80s, Steve is the man who first took me to the Stay Out All Night discotheque in Stone Park.
Yeah, I was there once or twice.
Performing on a Sunday night was Jeff Garlin.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So that was a few years ago. So like Steve said about Joe Brill saying, hey, you've got to come to Stanley's, Steve did the exact same thing with me.
And how long ago was that?
Maybe 5, maybe 6 years ago. The first night that Steve brought me there, my first thought was, I've got to bring my wife Mary here. So the very next night, we loaded up the car, we went to Stanley's. The minute my wife walked in the door, she said, we're having our wedding anniversary, our 20th wedding anniversary party here at this bar. And that was about a year and a half away, and our friends couldn't have been happier. We had a wonderful time there.
Walter and Dominic, describe the vibe there. I know, Dominic, you were there and stuff. I mean, what makes it, why are these guys attracted to it so much? What makes it so unique? Talk about the house drinks, the food. I mean, just create a scene for the listeners.
Walter? Well, I think the one of the unique things of the bar had always been that essentially whatever the food was that was served in the bar was really the same food that my family ate. So there was absolutely no different. So whatever quality of food, you know, we would serve at really a holiday meal or a normal day meal was a typical lunch fare at the bar. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much a casual environment. I would say there were, generally speaking, two distinct groups of customers that were working men that would stop in for short periods of time, and there were people that were more of the community that would stay longer, such as Ken, and come and visit and that type of thing. And it was just a casual environment. It still is a casual environment. The missing element, of course, is that Wanda would share her free advice with the customers, oftentimes unvarnished advice.
Yeah. She would always ask me if I was keeping busy at work.
Yeah.
She always wanted to know how things were going at my job.
Yeah,
she was. And her tagline saying that she would tell most customers, she'd tell people to behave.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you hit on something, Steve. You mentioned Marie's Riptide. You know, Marie, I think of we've talked about Phyllis's musical, you know, although Phyllis isn't there that much. But these women really had a face of the tavern. I mean, Wanda was Stanley's there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
She ran the business with her brother, beginning in the late 50s, and then her brother, my Uncle Ted, passed away in 1983. And then at that point forward, the business really transformed into her business, and she was the face of Stanley's. It was really, really, in modern days, more of Wanda's business than it was my grandfather Stanley,
yeah,
no doubt about that.
She was the main attraction.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she lit the place up when she walked out of that back room, out of that kitchen, you know, and everybody said, hey, Wanda, you know. And she would sit down and talk with you for hours, actually, at a time.
Yeah. She would.
My wife and I would go there for lunch, and we would take along my mother-in-law, who is in her mid-80s, and she and Wanda hit it off like like long lost family members. They would sit and talk for hours while we had lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Music on the jukebox. We heard some of it.
We have a jukebox that is a 1953 Rockola jukebox. Wow. 120 records. There's ample supply behind what's on the machine today, and the family bought it new and works today, and we expect it to be working tomorrow as well.
Is
it
10 cents a song, 3 for a quarter, and a nice selection of polka music.
Exactly.
And the thing that I really like about Stanley's is there's an old saying in the bar game, and that is if you walk past a bar on the streets and you can't see in the windows, they don't want you to see in the windows. Well, Stanley's, it's such a well-lit room. When you're there in the daytime, it's just there's just a beautiful, warm, brown, gold glow to it because there are windows that let in the light. It's a warm and inviting atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's not some grubby bar. It's what you want it to be. I've always said that it seems like it wouldn't be that difficult to run a bar. What do you need? You need a room, you need a bar, you need some liquor. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that, but Wanda, Walter, everybody in your family, your grandfather figured it out back in the 20s, and it still works.
No, and let me just comment that I think if my aunt were here today, she would tip her hat to all the other families, probably Chicago families, particularly some of the Southside families, the Schaller family, the right. Schmidt family. Mm-hmm. People who have built and maintained saloon businesses, and it's no easy business. A simple matter is you're on your feet all day long, and that food has to be cooked, and the shelves have to be stocked, and it's certainly not an easy thing to do.
Do you guys have any idea? I mean, they always say it was one. I know Schaller's is closed, and that had a very old liquor license. Was it one or two or three? I don't know where the Berghoff sits and all
that. The Berghoff's is one.
Yeah, really. Yeah. But I wouldn't call the Berghoff a slip. But
I'm with you, Dave. Yeah. I'm completely with you on that one.
But do you know how old the liquor license was? Is it Stanley's?
Yeah, I would say that, well, first of all, our first liquor license was 1924. It's a hard thing to measure, but I think it would be fair to say that we're probably one of a handful of Chicago liquor licenses that are still run and maintained by the same original founding family.
Wow.
I think it's fair to say that possibly with the exception of Berghoff on the entire south side of Chicago, we would be the oldest saloon in the city. And as I say, we certainly respect everyone else in this business because anyone who's been in the game for a long, long time has worked very, very hard.
Outside of Joe Brill, have you had any celebrity customers and stuff?
Hey, yeah, Ken Motti, well, the mayor of Rockville, and Steve Mandel drink their regular.
I mean, any politicians come in?
Yeah, we've had a number of politicians, and the mayors have been in.
All the mayors?
Not all, but we've had a couple.
The Southside mayors.
Yeah, Southside mayors and an alderman. And I think the funniest thing is that we've had so many large and huge and powerful men physically. And everyone to a person would say to Wanda, if you need anything, just give me a call. I'll take care of the problem for you. So we look at that with some admiration.
Yeah.
You know, Stanley's was part of a whole ring of taverns.
Yeah, right.
Down Ashland. It's called
Whiskey Row, yeah.
And at one point, there were over 40 taverns on Ashland Avenue at that location. So it was a tough business to make, to get enough men in to keep it going and things like that. They often cashed checks from the packing houses or from the stockyard company. It was a way stop on a way home. It was also a stop for lunch because a lot of the packing houses originally didn't have cafeterias. So they'd go out and they'd stop at the bars. There'd be a hot plate, not a hot plate, but a steam table, and you'd eat for free if you had a shot and a beer. And Stanley's walked right into that and is the last bar on Whiskey Row.
Yeah, and I would say on the food, probably for the first many years of the business, the food was really a giveaway. The food was just for the convenience of the customers. The customers came in to drink, and my grandmother would make food and put it out free of charge just as a nicety to the customers.
Now, we're going to take a break for the news here in a minute, but people would want to know what's the future. It's open again. It's open.
The business is open. We anticipate being open, and possibly with the exception of Wanda, it's a family business, and the family's no interest in really doing anything but moving forward.
Give the address again.
It's 4258 South Ashland. It's on the northwest corner of 43rd Street and Ashland, right across from the main entrance to the Chicago Stockyards.
And what is it? What are the hours? Did you tell me last call? Was
last
it 7?
Last call, I'm not sure if this is still the case, going to be the case, but last call was around 7:30 p.m.
Yeah, Wanda ran the business from 11 in the morning till 8 in the evening. But those hours may change in days to come.
I'm looking for a side job as a bartender.
Come on down.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break. You guys want to hang around a little bit? I want to get a little bit more into Wanda.
Please. And,
okay,
sure.
So we'll be back with more of a tribute to Stan Lee's on WGN after this.
Oh, that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart. For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart.
And welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and we're paying tribute to Wanda Kurek, who passed away June 18th at the age of 95. Proprietor of Stanley's. She, while we played that song, you told me that was her first rock concert.
Yeah, she saw Frank Sinatra live when she was a teenager.
And that was her first rock concert.
It was.
She missed a lot. Did she? I asked her once if she saw the Beatles at the International Amphitheater. I don't think that was up her alley.
The Beatles were not quite her style.
Yeah. talk about, people may not know about her background in fashion. She graduated the Vogue School of Fashion, and I didn't know this till last week. She wants to own over 100 McCall's dress patterns. So right, talk about that. That's where her sense of style came from, right?
Yeah, her passion really was dressmaking, dress design. She graduated high school in the height of World War II, and that would have been 1942, and began the Vogue Chicago School of Fashion, but then quickly ended that simply because she was called back to work in the family business since her brothers were in the war. And then in the 50s, she purchased the dress shop on 75th and Loomis and had a small dress shop for 3 or 4 years, and then would call back from that because, again, her father took ill, and she went back into the bar business. But that was really her passion. She made many outfits, designed many clothes. She was really fantastic with it.
Yeah. I'm guessing that's why Wanda liked me and could tolerate me, because I would always show up. I tend to wear a shirt and necktie no matter what I do.
You're dressed up here.
Well, like Steve said, I'm dressed for radio.
Yeah, right.
My heroes in fashion were Commissioner Gordon on the Batman TV series and Eddie Albert on Green Acres. Yeah. I said, that's how you do it. That's how you put on your stump grubbing suit.
So you would come to the bar dressed up?
Yeah. I would come there straight from work. I work in the western suburbs, and I found out that at like 2:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday, I could make it from the western suburbs to Stanley's in 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
I would jam, and I would get there, and Wanda was always, she was happy to see every person that walked into that bar. She really was, and she made you feel so welcome, and just seeing her little head peeking up over the bar, because she was a small woman.
Very short, yes.
Very small. Very, but she filled that room with her personality.
You told me you always felt like you belonged. That was a common theme there.
I really did. Being, like I said, coming to Chicago from southeastern Iowa and being a farm kid, you always kind of have a chip on your shoulder about, oh, here I am in the big town. But it was like finally coming to Stanley's with my wife, with my friend Steve, I really, really, after all these years living in Chicago, I felt like I belong here.
Yeah.
My wife and I, the very first funeral that we ever attended for one of the barkeepers that we ever went to was Paul Fong, who was owner-operator of Chef Shangri-La in North Riverside. We went to his visitation because my in-laws were personal friends with Paul and his wife, Susie. So when Wanda passed away and I got a personal text from Rich, one of the bartenders there, that was just it. And then going to the visitation, I felt like, yeah, this was a very special woman. She was a very, very special person, a cornerstone of Chicago.
Dominic, when people went there and talked to Wanda, and you're a historian, what's lost when this oral history goes away?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Like, some of us try to preserve that oral history,
right.
But a lot of it's lost. Wanda was a character, Chicago used to be a city of characters. There was a lot of people who were, you know, a little on edge or a little off edge or a little roundabout. And Wanda was one of those people. And she was fantastic. Her heart was just, you know, open to everybody. She was a great person. But she was a character. And she, she drew people into that bar. I mean, she drew me in. You know, my family grew up around the corner from there.
Uh-huh.
And knew a lot of the same people and went to the same church when I was younger, before it closed, Sacred Heart. And people were just drawn to that place.
Yeah.
It was a good, respectable bar on Whiskey Row.
Whiskey Row, right.
Wanda really liked when Dominic came in because they were able to talk about the neighborhood. They both knew the same families. But what was really unique is that virtually everyone Dominic knew, Wanda knew that person's grandparents or parents. And
right.
You talk about Whiskey Row. How many women had a face on Whiskey Row? I mean, was this rare that Wanda was?
I think it was not as rare as you might think. There were several bars close by that were run by women. Maybe in the early days it was mostly a male institution. Let's see, before World War One, World War Two, but it changed over time. You know, Whiskey Row was one of those places. People in the neighborhood, there were two kinds of taverns in back of the yards. There were the taverns on Whiskey Row, which anybody could go to, black, white, Hispanic, whatever. And you'll see the same mix today at Stanley's. Then there were the bars on the inside of the community. There were about three bars per block in back of the yards. I think on my block there were five. So that's a lot of bars per block. But those places were more closed off. It was a Lithuanian bar. You didn't go in if you were Polish. If you were German, you didn't go into a Polish bar. You know, these were very, but not on Whiskey Row. Whiskey Row was open to everybody.
We've always had an eclectic mix of customers. Yeah. Proud to say that we still do.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, Wanda embraced diversity in the sense that when she rolled up her wet towel and snapped it in your face, you know, you knew it was time to leave, whatever planet you were born on.
And every time I go to the bar, I end up having a conversation with someone at the bar that I would not have met otherwise at any other place in my life. They say that in your life you have your home, your job, and then you need that third place.
Third place, yeah.
And
yeah,
third place. Stanley's is absolutely third place. I have met one of my favorite people that I met there was a man who had a degree from an Ivy League school out east, and he was working here for one of the recycling companies, not as an executive, as a guy on the truck.
Yeah.
There's a story right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's always been an interesting place, and Wanda would talk to me in Polish too, which was kind of fun for both of us. And but you're right about that clot. She could hit you with it. I remember somebody saying, Wanda, you know, I don't like liver. She said, go to the There's the door. Around the corner is McDonald's. Go eat there. I mean, she told it like it was.
She did.
And credit where credit is due to Dominic. You appear in a documentary about the Polish in Chicago, and you were interviewed sitting at the bar at Stanley's.
Actually, the documentary, a couple of documentaries I've been in, the documentary you're talking about was called The South Side. And that's with Jeffrey Barron. He brought me in there 5-6 years ago, we sat there and talked with Wanda, et cetera. It was great fun. Now, I had known Wanda before, but it was at that point that I started coming in regular into the bar.
Okay, in the time we have left, I want to go around the table and talk about your projects outside of going to Stanley's. So, you got a book coming out, Dominic?
Yeah, I do. In the fall, it's called American Warsaw, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of Polish Chicago. It's University of Chicago Press.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be busy, right?
We're busy. The business is open, and we're looking forward to welcome back all of our friends from over the years.
Are you going to make any changes? You wouldn't tell me if you are.
we're trying to improve our parking situation,
which
is a little tight. But other than that, I think the same room will be the same.
I kind of lost track there. What time is last call?
Well, it was 8 p.m.
8
p.m. We're open a little later now, but that's all now in the process of being redefined in a sense.
Okay. All right. K Ken Motti.
Oh, I'm the busiest man in pretend show business.
Gin Palace Jesters.
I play in a traditional and original country and western band called the Gin Palace Jesters. You can find us on Facebook, Gin-Palace-Jesters. And I'm also involved in a show that can be seen on YouTube that's called the Chicago Vintage Show, that is sort of like the Tonight Show, but with all rockabilly and tattoo stuff and vintage and swing dance stuff. And I get to play Johnny Carson. It's the most fun I've had in my show business career, and I am making air quotes with my fingers. Okay.
Steve Mandel, what are you up to?
I'm going to continue exploring, looking for lots of gems in places like Stanley's across the city and help spread the word.
What do you, last question, what do you learn when you go to these places, the sense of history? I mean, that's real important to you.
Yeah, because I just love... I don't like where we're headed. I don't like the music. You know, I sound old, but...
you kids with your live music.
And you are old.
I'm just not a fan of what's going on now, and I like this old history, and I like talking to these people. Mm-hmm. Joe Dano, who owned Bucket of Suds, if he were alive today, he'd be 103 years old. Mm-hmm. And I just learned so much history from him about the city and how things were.
You know what? They have time for you.
I used to.
Right. That's they right. And one of the things that I noticed about whether it was Marie or Wanda or Joe Dano is that none of these people wanted to just stay at home and sit and watch TV. Being around all these people coming in, and especially younger people, all these people could have been my grandparents. And they enjoyed talking mm-hmm. with people. And I think if they didn't have that every day and just sat in a chair, they probably wouldn't have lived as long as they did. And I think not necessarily the bar business itself, but just talking with people and being around and sharing their knowledge, that there were people that wanted to.
Wanda once told me, she said, what am I going to do, sit and look at the park? I want to talk to people.
I used to say to Wanda, I wasted the first 52 years of my life not coming to Stanley's. I'm making up for lost time.
Good for you. Well, thank you so much. It's a great place. Shout out the address again, Wally.
4258 South Ashland Avenue, Chicago. Thanks so much, Dave.
And you'll still have Bear games on Sunday.
We'll have it all.
She loved that. All right, thank you. Thanks a lot. We'll be back with more Nocturnal Journal after this. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. And on the phone, we have John Fontaine, Director of Consumer Launch for Reed Exhibitions, and he's overseeing the outside experience at Chicago, in Chicago, that goes up July 13th and 14th. Are you there, John?
I am. How are you?
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So tell us the who, what, when, where, why, and how of the outside experience. Is this the first one here in Chicago?
This is the first one. So Outside Experience really is a celebration of the culture and lifestyle of outdoor and adventure sports, July 13th and 14th over at McCormick Place in the Lakeside Center building. And we go Saturday 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Sunday 10 to 5.
And let's break it down.
Sure.
Outside, active lifestyle brand. I'm interested. It's kind of presented. Some stuff is presented by Go RVing. So talk about all the components of this.
Certainly. So, yeah, Outside Magazine is the kind of the original magazine for the outdoor and adventure space. It actually was founded in Chicago, so that's a little bit of history there with the brand and the show. So the show will be actually broken up into 12 different adventure zones that really cover pretty much everything you see in the magazine. Our adventure vehicle zone, which is sponsored by our presenting sponsor, Go RVing, will have a number of different adventure vehicles. I'm not talking the big motorhomes, but really cool towable, lightweight stuff, van life, that type of thing. We've got a running zone for trail running sponsored by Salomon. We hit the water, both inside and outside. We'll have a water zone inside with a fly casting tank from Orvis, and then we'll be paddling at 31st Street Harbor with a number of brands there, including Hobie and L.L. Bean. We've got an indoor climbing zone with a climbing wall of 8 lanes on it, a trail zone for kind of like hiking and camping, a winter zone, adventure travel, biking with a really neat e-bike demo course with 2 ramps, a kind of wellness and lifestyle zone we call Live Well with a fitness demo stage, camping zone, a pet zone with some dog adoptions from one of the local rescues in town,
one tail
at a time. Yeah, and then our backyard zone, which will host a $5,000 guaranteed purse cornhole tournament.
Oh, wow. Boy, you got a lot going on there. Talk about some of these things, running zone. So what happens there when people check out the running zone? What do you do?
So we've actually built out a indoor trail running trail complete with rocks, logs, mulch, dirt, you name it, elevation gains and all. So people will be able to try the newest Salomon Supercross trail shoes and their Speedcross 5. Try them on right there, have their gait analyzed, take a little clinic class in how to trail run, and then strap on those new Supercross and take them for a spin.
And something like the Winter Zone, which we get a lot of that anyway in Chicago. You've got what happens at the Winter Zone, and I see here there's a Tin Cup Whiskey Lodge.
Actually, we're just going with Stranahan. So Stranahan's Whiskey and Tin Cup are you know, companies under one brand, but it's just going to be Stranahan's at the show. Our Winter Zone will have a few kind of smaller outdoor brands, winter brands, including one local Viking Ski Shop. But Stranahan's will be there with some whiskey sampling and their really cool Airstream set up right at the entrance to the show.
And you mentioned van life. I talked to you briefly this morning. I mean, I did a book on camper vans and driving around the country in a camper van. And it's really, really exploding with a younger demographic. I mean, and there's people with, you know, doing telecommuting. I ran into a couple in Key West, and they were from the Boston area, and they just spent the, you know, the winter in Key West working and stuff. Talk about how that's trending up with a younger audience, maybe retirees too.
Yeah, well, the real focus for Go RVing, which is the marketing arm of the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association, is to target the millennial crowd with these kind of lighter weight vehicles, smaller vehicles, less expensive vehicles. Obviously, conversion vans are a big part of that. If you follow Instagram, you know it's a thing. And it's really a remarkable new phenomenon. And, you know, a lot of the biggest adventurers, think Alex Honnold from Free Solo, he, you know, lives in a van half the year and is able to travel around the country and climb all over. So we're excited to see some of the stuff that comes from Go RVing and including having a tiny house in there, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm going to get to the tiny houses in a little bit. Talk about teardrop trailers for the listeners who don't
teardrops.
Know.
I think we've got a few teardrops on site. So a teardrop is really a vintage style trailer. They've been, you know, remade in a lighter fiberglass, very small interior, just, you know, sleeping quarters, and the back opens up like a clamshell to reveal a kitchen. But you can tow it with a Mini Cooper.
Yeah, yeah, and you're seeing more and more of those around too.
Absolutely.
Is there a website where people can find out more information? What are the hours for this?
Yeah, certainly. It is outsideexperienceshow.com is the website, and all the information's there, including links for tickets, and then obviously we have our social handles as well.
And are you on site at these? I mean, I assume you've done them in other cities.
Yeah, no. We work for a company called Reed Exhibitions. So in Chicago, C2E2, the big comic and entertainment expo, is an event we do. So I'm really familiar with the city. We run about 50 events in the U.S. alone, but this is the first for Outside and Reed as a partnership for Outside Experience Show.
I mean, have you done other outside? My question would be, like, what kind of questions do people have? Are there things they ask about?
You know, they're going to want to know what's going on, what they can do. You know, it's a very family-friendly event, so we've got everything for, you know, kids 2 and up. And I say kids because the adults are kids, too, with this. You know, the climbing wall will be there. People can climb with our friends from Brooklyn Boulders out of Chicago. They're going to be running the climbing wall. We've actually got a rappelling station set up. So you'll be able to rappel off the patio at Lakeside Center down to the Lakeside Trail right below it. Obviously, the cornhole tournament, and when the tournament's not going, it's open cornhole play, fly casting, clinics, and demos. So if you've never tried fly casting, you can try that. Our e-bike course, we've got a kids' bike demo area with batch bicycles. And I think the most fun for the kids will be the kids' adventure zone, where we'll have ninja courses, slack line, zip line, all for the kids to really enjoy. And I think the main highlight really is our Yeti main stage, sponsored by our friends at Yeti. We built out a round stage in the center of the show floor to really mimic sitting around a campfire and telling stories. So we've got programming on that stage all day long, and Saturday afternoon we actually have a concert from a band out of Missouri, actually named after a state park in Missouri called Ha Ha Tonka. So they go on in the early afternoon.
Yeah.
So they'll be on site. on Saturday afternoon, kicking off probably about 4:15, 4:30. And opening for them, we've got another Chicago native group, Treehugger Comedy. So they'll be doing some of their outdoor comedy as an opening act for the band.
How'd you find these bands?
You know, the band thing, we went through a few. We were searching around for some local bands, Midwest bands. We had one lined up, ready to go, but turns out that the Sunday of our show, one of the band members is getting married, so we went with Ha Ha Tonka. Well, we're excited to have them. You know, one of their main videos is the whole band on a river flotilla of rafts with a bunch of people hanging out in the outdoors, so it makes perfect sense.
It is the Outside Experience, July 13th and 14th at the McCormick Place Lakeside Center. Before we let you go, talk about the Tiny House and Simple Living Jamboree. Now, will that be in Austin?
So actually, the Tiny House Simple Living Jamboree is a show we ran for a couple of years. We actually, as a consumer show where people can just come tour houses, it doesn't really exist anymore. We've actually moved it into our national hardware show portfolio, which is more on the trade side. You know, a lot of the builders in that growing industry, there's a lot of education that happens. And also for the builders, it's kind of one-stop shopping to meet with all their suppliers. But for a couple of years, we did run that event in Texas. We had over 65 different tiny houses last year in Austin. They're real neat, and we're excited to have one this year as well. So if you haven't seen a tiny house, but you've seen them on TV, this is a perfect opportunity to come down and tour a tiny house and see if it would work for you.
So there will be one at the Outside Experience.
Yes, there will be. Yes, sir. Yep.
I just saw a thing in my feed this week about Amazon selling tiny houses.
Did you
see that build-it-yourself kits starting at just over $5,000? You can build one in two days.
It's an interesting phenomenon, you know, and more and more municipalities are starting to accept them as dwellings. You know, California just revised some laws as accessory dwelling units for like backyard granny flats and rental properties. So I think you're going to continue to see growth in that, especially on kind of the modular and manufactured small structured side.
Describe a tiny house for listeners who may not know what we're talking about.
So typically, you know, the TV version is on a trailer that's anywhere from 18 to 36 feet long, sometimes with a gooseneck. So they have a footprint of anywhere from, you know, call it 180 to 300 and some odd square feet. There are something called a park model home, which you typically find in like RV parks that are 400 square feet. You know, they could be on foundations, they could be on wheels and movable. Now storage containers are turned into homes.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
You know, it's really a phenomenon of minimalizing and downsizing and just saying, I don't need all this space. You know, for a small family, it works. For a single person, it works. For retirees, it works. And it's a great way to, you know, to have a place that you can call your own without having a mortgage.
Yeah, do you see that tying in with, we were just talking about, you know, vans and teardrop trailers?
Yeah.
Again, the idea of simplifying your life and not just having all this baggage around you, you know?
That's really what it's about. It's really about that simple living aspect and just saying, you know what, I don't need all that stuff. I don't need all that space. I don't need all that expense. So just downsize a little bit. And, you know, if tiny house to you means a 1,200 square feet, great. You know, from call it 4,000 down to 1,200, that's great. That's tiny for you. So it really comes down to the individual's, you know, needs and how they can comfortably live.
Can you move them around?
Yeah, the ones on trailers, you certainly can. You know, one of the folks that worked for me in the tiny house jamboree in the past couple of years, she and her husband are in the Dallas area, and then in the winters they're in Minnesota. So they move it twice a year. They tow it back and forth. In the winter they're in Dallas, and the summer they're in Minnesota. Uh-huh. So they move it back and forth twice a year.
So the Outside Experience, July 13th and 14th here in Chicago at McCormick Place Lakeside Center. So maybe the last question here, if someone's coming and there's some really hot trends, give me two or three things that the antenna should be up for.
Definitely hit our climbing wall. That'll be amazing. We've got a great group of folks there to get you started. If you've never climbed, we want to create a really open, friendly environment to try something that you haven't tried. I also would put on the radar a couple of our guests that are on the main stage. Actually, both are Chicago natives, Nate Fluellen He will speak on Saturday about 11:30. Nate grew up on the South Side and now hosts a web series called Worldwide Nate, where he travels the world. He is actually going to do about 15 minutes on stage, and then we'll be bringing up a couple of the kids from some of our charity programs that take the inner city kids out into the wilderness, you know, hiking and camping, and he'll do a little panel with what those programs meant to him. And then the other on Sunday would be Kelly Edwards, another Chicago native who is the host of Travel Channel's Mysterious Islands and a pilot. So super excited to hear those two on stage and hear the stories they have to tell.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on a Friday night. John Fontaine, Director of Consumer Launch for Reed Exhibitions, and it's the Outside Experience coming to Chicago on July 13th and 14th. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll be back after this on WGN.
The Hitless Wonders turned the trick back in 1906. Shoeless Joe, please say that it ain't so. Many years were dark at the famed Comiskey Park, till Applin came with aches and pains and fouled off 10 or so. Talking baseball, Benura and Big Ed, Sox baseball.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Joe. Ro, you're going to learn something in this segment.
Hoping too.
So we're going to talk about, thank you guys for all coming in, White Sox Parks, Amazing Vendors. It's a bestseller by Lloyd Rutsky and Joel Levin. Lloyd, you're in the studio tonight. Get up that microphone.
Yeah. Okay.
So vendor Lloyd Rutsky and Bob, introduce yourself.
Bob Chacoin.
Lloyd Rutsky.
Our friend.
Doug North, thanks for having me.
And Abe.
Abe Rapik.
Thanks for joining us, Abe.
No problem.
You guys are all friends. So we did a segment when your Wrigley Field book came out.
That's correct.
So talk about how this came out. Was this always planned? You're going to do two together?
Well, the original plan was that we had we're going to have one book with both teams, with their pictures. But the publisher somehow thought that. Well, maybe the Cubs were a little more popular at the time. I don't know where they got this crazy idea. But anyway, and since I had so many pictures, and I also thought that the Sox fans really don't want anything with Cubs to do with it, and most Cub fans are pretty have the same thought. So we'll get two books if the first one's successful, and the first one was successful. So this year we've got White Sox Parks Amazing Vendors, me and Joel Levin, and that's... It came out 2 weeks ago, and we're pretty excited about it.
Arcadia Publishing.
Yes.
.com is how people can find them. Uh-huh. For people who are haven't heard the story before, how'd you find the pictures? How many pictures are in the book?
I found them because I took them.
All of them.
Like 90%.
Yeah.
I started taking pictures in about 1971. I was going to Columbia College, and I got a Nikon camera to take professional type pictures at the time, and I started taking pictures. And when I had started working at the ballpark in 1965, and by 1970 I was thinking, well, I probably wouldn't be vending much longer or whatever, but I still wanted to take pictures of people so I would remember them, you know, 5, 10 years, 15 years, and I started, you know, taking pictures of my friends was one thing, but then I'd start taking pictures of people, of guys I didn't know, stand workers, the slight ushers, and what they thought I was. Pretty crazy.
What did people say?
Well, you called me a screwball. You know, why do you want my picture? And then because I would, you know, get their picture, and I would get their name too, as most in 90% of the cases. And, you know, just hopefully that we would have something to remember them. And they thought I was nuts, but like 10 years later, people started, you know, I would bring these, I was still working, and I'm still working now 55 years later.
Yeah.
At the White Sox. Before identity theft, they thought you were the first guy doing it.
And so. Anyway, and then about 10 years later, people started looking at these pictures, and there's, you know, somebody, hey, this guy is no longer around, and that lady is gone, and these parts of the ballpark, it's no longer there. There's buildings across the street and things like that. There's different. So they were pretty, you know, very happy that I had taken these pictures. Of course, now 50 years later, it's, you know, they're classics.
When did you get the idea to make it into a book?
Well, actually, my idea wasn't, I'd always wanted to do something with my pictures, but I didn't really, I was, you know, kind of never putting anything together, but my friend Joel Levin, who had vented, he hasn't vented for like 40 years, but he vented before me, and he had an idea to write a book about it, but he needed, you know, pictures, and he knew that I'd taken a lot of pictures, including a couple of him and his brothers, and His one brother. And he approached, you know, he's trying to find a publisher, and he found Arcadia Publishers, and they thought, you know, they were intrigued by the idea. And then we got to meet with them, and it took about a year or two of negotiations, and finally they agreed, you know, we'll do it. You know, we'll see what they saw, all the pictures I had. I have like 1,000 at least, and, you know, like 950 of them are real good.
And what did you use? What type of equipment?
A Nikon camera, mostly. And then other people had cameras, too. This guy, Mike Gold, and a few others. And to this book, Dave Levinson, who's a vendor now, he contributed a few pictures. But most of them are mine.
And you know, it transcends. It's not a vanity project. Because when you look at this, and same thing with the Cubs book, I mean, it just takes anybody who's a baseball fan back into the stands, and it brings back, you know, all kinds of memories and stuff. Did you get that response with the Wrigley Field one? Have you had that with this one?
Oh, yeah. Everyone has seen it, really seems to like it a lot, and they just are so happy that these guys are, you know, some of these pictures I really didn't think, you know, big deal, you know. There's somebody, but there's always somebody who knew that person, and they're seeing, you know, somebody's mother. This was that's my mother, and that's my uncle, and so.
Like, for instance, I had forgotten about, I put this in yellow, Lou the Shoeshine Man's place at Old Comiskey.
Yeah. You know,
I'd forgotten about that until I saw it in your book.
Yeah, yeah.
You talk about that. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You would see, I think there was at least two of them, but maybe he was the only one.
You got extra spit if you had wing tips.
There we go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they did. They had a shoeshine guy.
He had a chair. He had his little box.
And then his athletic shoes took over.
Yeah, there's a picture of him on, where is it?
And they're doing stuff like that again now. Like in Brooklyn, they put in a barbershop where they, you know, where the Nets now play and stuff like that.
Where's the picture of
with a quartet.
Bob, when did you start? When did you start vending?
You know, I started vending. Jimmy Carter was the newly elected president. I don't like to really think how many years it was, but that makes me a whippersnapper next to these guys.
Yeah.
I've only got 42 years in, I think, and they've got many more than that.
And where did you start at? Which arena?
White Sox.
White Sox.
Yeah. Beer was 80 cents back then, but you only got 12 ounces. So you're just paying $9.20 for the extra 4 ounces because they now sell 16 ounce beers.
Bob wants to talk about being a whippersnapper. I'm a whippersnapper at 24 years.
Yeah.
I started at Cubs in 1996, and I was at White Sox from 2000 to 2012. So hearing these stories, you know, over the years really gave me an idea of what I had missed out. In 24 years, there's still a lot of history before me. I'm in the middle of the pack when it comes to the world of the vendors. I'm glad Lloyd put out two books, because for this type of city, we need two books. There's two teams, and we're very divided in terms of our allegiances. And people remember specifically one side of town versus the other side of town, and that hits that memory from wherever anybody else happened to be at that game in that seat.
That's why I wanted you on the panel. What did you learn when you started with these guys? How old were you? You were 16 when you started?
I was 16 when I started. Well,
how did you look at this generation?
Loud.
Yeah.
Intrusive. Yeah. Aggressive. And at 16 years old, I didn't know what to say other than, you know, I'm going to stay out of the way and pay attention to the world around me, and maybe I'll learn something. Because ultimately, you know, we're there to make money. But in order to make money, we have to sell things. We have to connect with people. So how do you do that best? So I had to take a look around at my colleagues and see what they've been doing for years. And then I showed up.
Is there a certain, I guess everybody has a different style, you know? Is there a shtick? I mean, some people scream. There's that one guy used to say.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of people who scream.
I don't like that.
There are characters. Yeah. There are characters. I think they're like, it's like a Crayola crayon box. Uh-huh. Every vendor is very, very, very different. Yeah. And you have to figure out how you connect with the ballpark and the fans and what you feel comfortable doing, because, Lloyd, Bob, and Abe and myself, we're very different in how we vend these seats.
Explain that. Each one of you talk about what your style's like. Abe?
Well, I started in 73, I think. And then at Sox, I'm not even sure when I started. It was like 2 or 3 years later. But everyone has their different style. I joke around with the
people. Yeah, you're accessible. You're accessible. You're friendly.
Right. I mean, Doug's great with his regulars. Bob gives out baseball cards to people. And, Lloyd shows them the two different socks. Yeah, you know, stuff crazy.
What do you do, Lloyd?
Well, I don't show him. I have different socks.
He wears shorts it's snowing. Yeah. And he has two different pairs of socks on, so it's obvious. It's like, one, that vendor is wearing shorts, and it's 35 degrees out and snowing. And not only is he wearing shorts, his socks don't match. So let's talk with that guy while we're having him pour us a beer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you say, Lloyd, are you cold? He raises his fist, goes, I fight the cold.
I'm about ready to.
It's not cold. It's beautiful.
It's not beautiful.
I think for me, it's been an evolution over time. I started when I was 16, so I sold the pop, the peanuts, the hot dogs. I've sold it all, and up until in 2000, that's when I started getting beer. That's when I turned 21. So, you know, at that point, it changed. So whatever product I had, it changed, right, because I was appealing to a different audience. That's me. And so I evolved over time to just connect with people. I think, you know, Dave, you see me more than you see these guys. I think you can speak to that.
Yeah, right.
Did you ever evolve into the loud, intrusive type that you saw when you first started?
No, I pretty much said I don't want to be that. I just if I'm scared of it or if I'm just like put off by it, I'm like, I don't want to be that. But I think that was just me and my perception. I think within the context of the ballpark, though, they see us, they see other vendors as characters. I don't want to say superheroes. I mean, you guys are my superheroes, but it's like, man, I want to talk to these guys. I want to buy a beer from them because they're very, very different.
All right, we got to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more of White Sox Park's amazing vendors on the eve of the Cub Sox. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, White Sox Park's amazing vendors. We played Pablo Cruz because on August 19th, 1978, I was there. Steve Miller Band, the Eagles, Pablo Cruz at Comiskey Park. Now, Doug, you were too young, but Abe, Chico, what's it like to vend a rock concert?
Well, you needed your four tracks to really get all of Pablo Cruz, didn't you? Yeah, they just started in fact, some of those rock concerts, I think, did worse damage to the Comiskey Park field than Disco Demolition Night, because they'd have the concerts, they wouldn't really cover the field, they'd have it after rain, and it'd just be... But that's where they experimented with the concerts at Comiskey, and now, of course, Wrigley and the other venues have taken over.
They had some great stuff. Scorpions, we're talking about rock concerts at Comiskey. Scorpions, Iron Maiden, Girls' School, that was on August 5th. 1982. You're a music guy, Abe.
Yeah, but for some reason, I just remember working the Rolling Stones there.
Yeah,
unless Stones. I worked other concerts.
Well, it's mentioned in the
but that was the new one. I'm talking about pre-91.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Oh, in the old park.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, the old park had other things.
They had the Beatles, right?
Yeah,
when Ira
you didn't work.
No, I
Abe,
didn't
you
work
didn't work that.
No, I wasn't the vendor.
It was
right, but we know vendors that actually worked the Beatles concert.
I could have. There was a 19. There was like a month after I started, and somebody told me that I couldn't work it, and I was stupid enough to believe him, and so I didn't.
And I worked pro wrestling there a few times, which was
August 65.
These people were drinking like they were going to the electric chair in the morning. This is Dick the Bruiser days, Crusher days, Stan Hansen against Rick Martel.
Are
awesome
you sure you
fights.
Weren't in the ring, Abe?
I wanted to be, but no, that's when they had the yellow jackets. They didn't even know what to do because I don't think they'd had ever seen
crazy people
like this.
They were drinking so much,
like
they
this.
Were doing the Vern Gagne sleeper hold on themselves.
They had roller derby.
Yeah.
I worked roller derby,
yeah,
I think.
They had 50,000 people for that. And people, our union president said, no, they'd be like, our steward thought that, oh, there'll be like, you know, 5,000 or 6,000. But this was 1972, and this was, it was mania. The people were so hopped up on this every Sunday night that Dave Pound and Dave Hop, Bill Hoppy Hop, and
this wrestler Stan Hansen. I don't know if you remember him. He was like a big cowboy guy. He was fighting Rick Martel like a pretty boy from Canada, but Martel was tough as nails. So they jumped out of the ring at the end of the match, and Hansen hits him with the cowbell, and he lassoes him, and he's dragging him by his neck to the I think it was the White Sox dugout, and the security didn't know what to do. It's like they thought it was real. They tried to break it up, but they couldn't, and then they just disappeared down the tunnel.
That was the original. And, gotta have more cowbell.
They both got disqualified.
Ro, I told you, you learned something tonight on Nocturnal Journal. So, I mean, it's an obvious question, but rock and roll audiences, crowds, are different than baseball crowds.
Well, we found out for sure on Disco Demolition night, because that night, it was not a scheduled doubleheader. It was a makeup the doubleheader. So, normally, the game was originally scheduled like it's 7 o'clock, I think, something like 7:30 at the time. So they had it's 6 o'clock, and usually for a game that wasn't scheduled, there would be like 3,000 people. By 6 o'clock that night, the place was full.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, they were full. Like 90% of the people were not the White Sox fans.
Yeah, right.
They were all these people who got in with a disco record for 89 cents,
right.
87 cents. You knew right away this was going to be it was insane. It was like a mass pass out of beer, or people would just surround you when you would take your load out, and they could kill you or they could take
What were you vending that night?
I was selling beer.
And what kind of beer? Do you remember?
Oh,
Falstaff, I think. No?
It was
glass bottles or paper cups?
No, good question.
Oh no,
glass bottles. You had to pour them.
It
was 12 ounce cans.
No, it was cans.
Oh, was cans?
Candemonium.
79. It was
okay. It was 79.
What section were you in, like?
Oh, I was on third base side.
Was the beer cold or was it sort of?
It was pretty cold, but
did it matter?
They wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have mattered.
What music, Lloyd? What music were you listening to in 1970? Was it 78 or 79? I wrote that.
79.
79.
That's when I was born.
It's almost the 40th anniversary.
Yeah, right. Yeah, next week, July 12th.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, I used to take the train down there at the time. And I knew something was wrong that night. I was on the L going downtown, and everyone was on. All these young kids are wearing these black T-shirts, Disco Sucks, and Steve Dahl.
Yeah.
I go, what's going on? And they said, there's a thing. I didn't even know. I think I may have heard it.
I didn't. I mean, I was still listening to
music. It was crazy.
What were you listening to?
I was still listening. Well, the Bee Gees were still doing hits. And
did you like the Bee Gees?
Oh, I love the Bee Gees.
Oh, okay.
And, to me, disco was just rock and roll in a different form.
Yeah,
I
didn't understand why they were so upset, but it was more like the lifestyle of the disco people. And
well, I was there. I tell people it was a hot night. It was a kind of a sticky night, tonight.
It was crazy. Yeah. We would have done like 50 cases. I saw like 25 cases in the first game.
I took my record was Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart. I hated that record.
That was a good song.
Did you like that one?
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was the worst song.
No, it was a good hit.
Everybody charged the field that night except for Lloyd.
Yeah.
They stood up and applauded.
I was pretty sick seeing my park on fire. You know, people were on the field lighting fire.
Oh, yeah. When we did the book, Chico, you're in the book. When we did the book, everybody looked back at it with like a smile and a fond remembrance, except for Roger Bossert.
Oh, yeah.
And Bossert said, he goes, how would you like if somebody came into your house and turned over all your furniture?
Bill Beck didn't like that much either.
Yeah.
Please all the people all the time.
Yeah. He went on the field and he was yelling, go back to your seats, go back to your seats.
Yeah, these kids were climbing up over the wall to get in.
Yeah.
After a while, I wanted to leave because I knew. I had a feeling something bad was going to happen.
They
I want to be part of it.
The entranceways. They bolted the door. People are banging on the door by like 7 o'clock, trying to beat the way to get in because there was like 50,000 people there already, and would have had 70,000 or 80,000 if they let them in, and they were just stormed over the gates.
Chico, you worked at, where were you at again? What section? What were you selling?
I was in the upper deck, and actually when they cut off beer, I got deputized by some security guy. So he said, hold this section here. Hold them from going on it. And then he went away, and after 3 minutes, I thought, it's nice having a career as a deputy for 3 minutes, I think.
Kind of like being a substitute teacher.
Then the horsemen rode in, policemen on horseback, and got on the field.
When did we find out the second game was canceled? During the first game?
That night, I knew they would have to. Well, it was canceled. We immediately canceled.
And then we all checked out and ran home, I think. I don't think anyone really stuck around. Did you stick around?
What do you mean?
I mean, I just wanted to get out of there.
I went out to dinner. I went out to dinner.
No, but I'm saying you didn't stick around to watch it.
You went, Lloyd, you went to Faces, Lloyd.
The people going crazy.
The people, they threw him out. The cops.
It took them a while to throw him out.
Half hour.
After a riot, you're hungry. You got to eat.
They drove him out. And
yeah, it was insane.
And they called, you
know, those weren't baseball White Sox fans.
No.
It was like insane.
The Sox weren't doing that great there.
They weren't. No. But, it was. Lloyd, you're a Sox fan.
Oh, yes.
How'd that start?
Well, I'm born in the South Side. My father was a Sox fan. He started taking me to the ballpark when I was 4 or 5. And he'd listen to the games on the radio all the time. And became a White Sox fan, American League fan. I mean, most Sox fans like hate the Yankees, but no. I would hate them during the season. But when they came to the World Series and the White Sox weren't there, I would always root for my league to ruin. And the Yankees, you know, did pretty good. So,
what'd your father do? What'd your parents do?
Oh, my father was he had a various jobs. He was, the final job was a piano tuner, but before that, he was in the warehousing business with other people. You know, he worked. He worked the hard. He was the hardest working guy I ever knew. So, and
what neighborhood did you grow up in?
Oh, in the South Side, Southeast Side. Yeah, nice. I went to, graduated from Bowen High School. I went to Hirsch and also South Shore first, my first year and second year, and then we moved and I went to Bowen. So, yeah, and we moved to Glenview in 1969 when I was 21.
Robert, you're a Sox fan, aren't you, or not?
Yes, grew up on the South Side also. Several miles west of where Lloyd grew up, in what they call the Auburn area of Chicago. It was St. Flower Parish, was better known as back then, or Little Flower Parish.
Doug, Cubs?
I'm a Cubs fan, die hard. I came home after school and had my snack and popped on WGN, and I caught the Cubs bottom of the sixth, top of the seventh, and Harry Carey sang the stretch, and you know that's history for me. I always came home and day baseball was on, and that's how I fell in love with the Cubs.
Abe, we got a break real quick. Cubs, Sox, you're Cubs, aren't you?
Cubs.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm not a hater. I want the Sox to do well. It's not like Wrigley Field where they could just draw full houses automatically, but that's another topic.
We'll interrogate you after break.
Okay. Right. We're going to take a break. Thanks a lot. We're going to talk more about the book, White Sox Park, Amazing Vendors on WGN.
With us.
Yeah, that's what I like. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. We're talking the book, White Sox Park's Amazing Vendors by Lloyd Rutsky and Joel Levin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lloyd. We heard there Nana Hey Hey with Nancy. Talk about the difference between your clientele on the north side and the south side.
North side's a little more upscale, maybe more professional, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. But White Sox is it's a hearty crew. And I think years ago was much more the bigger difference because it was the neighborhood and maybe working class fans compared to the Wrigley. But I don't know. They both seem to draw a lot of, you know, good people. You know.
Bob?
Well, the pitch is a little different. At Wrigley, you say something like, gentlemen and ladies, my fine fellow citizens, might I interest you in some refreshing libations? Whereas at Sox, it's more like, you guys want a couple more brewskis?
Do you still tend to work at Wrigley?
No. Age got to me. Gave that up a few years ago.
What about the South Side?
I still work at Wrigley. It's the South Side.
Oh, the Sox you don't do. Yeah. Okay. Doug, you don't do the South Side.
I did the South Side from 2000 to 2012. I just remember it was more of a challenging vend than Wrigley Field, because I feel like on the South Side, you know, as Lloyd said, it's a working class, right? A working class group of people, right? And so they're thinking a lot about a lot more things financial than anything else. Where on the North Side, whatever the experience is, they're paying for it, and they're going to make sure that they have a good time. And money doesn't seem to be an object a lot of times.
It doesn't. I think money's more an object on the South Side. Right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And you got to respect that on both sides of town. But it's a hard, in my opinion, it's a harder vent on the South Side than it is on the North Side.
Yeah, Abe.
Well, Cub fans have always been. It seems like it's a different class than at Sox Park. But hey, I got a lot of. I'm a Cub fan, but I have a lot of friends at Sox Park. I used to joke around and say when I went to work at Cubs, I was like at a normal stadium. And when I went to work at Old Comiskey, it was like an ulterior universe, something totally different, which it is still today. It's a very different clientele of people, but it's fun at both parks.
They're it's nice. Not as, you know, I would tell people when we were doing the disco book, I mean, the Old Comiskey, that place was pretty wide open.
Yeah.
I mean, my first game was 65, Sox-Yankees. That was the first major league game I ever saw, and I was 10 years old, man. I just see these guys, people walking around with little pints of Jack Daniels and stuff. I go, my goodness, it was the Wild West.
There were fights right. almost yeah. every night.
Yeah.
Pretty much that was guaranteed, and you would sell whole cases to groups, and there wasn't as much of a definitely not alcohol responsible selling at the time, because people wasn't in the thinking of the public at the time. And you know, we would sell after the game even to the fans, and as they're leaving, we were, you know, selling cold can for the road, which is, you know, pretty dangerous stuff. But that nobody thought that like that back
then.
40 years.
No, they didn't think
It was not responsible at all, but that's people just got there and they just started drinking, and they drink in the parking lots, and they come in and they're still drinking. At Wrigley, they drink in the bars and they come in, but not to the extent that they did in 30, 40 years ago.
Did you guys ever get in the middle of anything?
Oh, well, one time, back at Wrigley, it was back before they had many concessions stands, and they didn't even have a commissary for the first base side. So I was taking we all got our cases from the third base side, and I was running over to the first base side trying to take care of all these people who weren't seeing a beer man. And I was getting there, and then people were would line up around me, so after like an inning or two, the fans behind me said they were getting pretty upset that I was there. People were coming over and blocking their view, and I was trying to get the people to come over, sit down, but finally these guys couldn't take it, and they just jumped on top of me and tried to rip my case right off my head. And luckily, the fans who were getting the beer, they took care of them.
How does that work of insurance and stuff? Are you guys covered by the union, or what happens? Like if something happens to you?
We have a union, if you're covered by an accident or in, you know, an incident like that, you're attacked by a fan, certainly you could, you have rights and things like that. But other than that, we don't get any salary. We don't get any sick days. We don't get any
health insurance.
So we just, you come and you make what you can. And
you make it by the hustle. Really?
Yeah,
really.
It's all commission.
Yeah, right.
Hustle on your personal shtick.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All you guys got it, yeah. Same thing for you guys. Have you ever gotten in the middle of a dust-up?
In
the Bill Veeck days, I would sometimes try to, being the responsible citizen, try to break up fights. And the last one I broke up, I got slugged at the same time by the two combatants. Fortunately, they were about three sheets to the wind, so I didn't have a jaw broken. But I thought, that's the end of my trying to break these up. From now on, I'll just step back and watch what happens.
Yeah.
I think it's never gotten to that point for me. I think at this point in time, it's so expensive for people to get to that point that doesn't happen. They get pretty obnoxious at times, but it's to my I've diffused a lot of things. I've diffused it, and it's to my benefit to diffuse it, because it's going to come back on me. So why are they behaving that way? Well, they're overserved. If they're overserved, who served them then? And on top of that, I don't want the people that I serve and that's around all that to experience that, because, you know, in this day and age, you've got kids.
Right.
You've got people that are up there in age, and nobody wants to experience that. So more times than not, it's to my best interest to diffuse it. And
when you say diffuse it, what do you do?
I basically say to them, I say, hey, he didn't mean it. We're just joking around. You know, is everything okay? That type of thing, right? Just kind of say, hey, what's your name? You know, and once you say, hey, what's your name? How you doing? You know, or are you a Cubs fan? You kind of divert their attention from the issue.
I know you. So does your background as a public school teacher help you deal with some of these Cub fans?
Absolutely, 100%. Vending in the seats at Wrigley isn't that different from teaching in the Chicago public schools, right? It's all about personal engagement, right? Hey, why are you doing this? Hey, are you having a good time? You know, or if it's a buddy system, like, hey, man, are you going to let your buddy, you know, get sick? Are you going to let your buddy throw you guys out of the stadium?
It's very smart.
You know, how much did you pay for this ticket? Is it worth getting thrown out of a ballpark? You know, that type of thing. You start using logic, and I know baseball, logic, good times, like, there's no place for logic. I'm having a good time, leave me alone. But in that moment, you use logic, and it pauses them for a minute. And, you know, at times I've had to run down the stairs and notify, you know, the ushers or security, say, hey, things are about to happen there. You need to get there now. And that stuff still happens.
Yeah.
I think I want Doug negotiating with Iran and North Korea.
Sure, why?
Yeah, it's very good. Abe.
I think it boils down to a lot what Lloyd was saying. Back then, there was no real alcohol awareness like there is today. And it just seemed, especially at night games, Friday night games at Sox Park, the Cubs didn't even have night games yet, the old Sox Park, you'd get groups of people from a bar in buses, like 60 or 100 people. Yeah. So you'd walk up an aisle, which is unheard of nowadays, and have a guy go, pour me 40. And he wasn't kidding. You'd have to sell yours, and if you didn't have two cases, say, wait for me, I'll be right back, and you'd run down. Those days are over with. They can't drink as much.
Yeah, right.
The cutoff is like in the seventh inning, after the seventh of both parks, basically. A Cubs is a little longer.
I've seen the Cubs go longer, yeah.
But no, the days of, I don't even know if the parks allow these bar groups to come in anymore. I've never seen
them. Well, there's just so many price points these days. People are spending their money on other things, where back in the day it was like, you have Old Style or something else and a hot dog and that's it.
Yeah, the only thing similar to the old Comiskey Park was the old County Stadium. You'd get groups of people. I mean, you go to County Stadium nowadays, they're still tailgating 3-4 hours before the game. Right. But it's a little different.
This is great stuff. We got to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more about White Sox Park's amazing vendors on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN and this fantastic book, White Sox Park's Amazing Vendors. Lloyd Rutsky, you're in the studio. How can people find the book?
You get it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or from the publisher Arcadia, and maybe soon you get it at White Sox Park.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah, I think that we're in negotiations with the bosses, and they've seen it, and I think maybe next time homestand it might be available at the gift shop there.
Maybe we'll get Disco Demolition in there, and they can do 2-for-1 now that they're embracing Disco Demolition.
Yeah.
Trying to plug all my books in one show.
A month early. Yeah. They went with it a month early.
So, Doug North, you're here. We're talking about, I want to talk about life after vending. So, Doug, I know you teach. So, talk about what you, I love the picture. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce his name right, with Harry Carey. Paul Smolson?
Yeah.
And he became a dental surgeon?
Yes, that's correct.
So talk about all you guys. What happens, you know, when you get out of this, when you don't want to do it anymore?
I can't tell you.
You've done 8,000, over 8,000 games.
Right, between ballparks. I probably have worked more baseball games in the seats than any person who's ever lived.
You know what we should do? I was just up this week. I went to the Bobblehead Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
There should be a Vendors Hall of Fame.
Well, there could be. we talk about that. In the last section is the legends.
Yeah, you know, right.
The legends and, of vending and other things. We have, like, Harry Carey's in the legends and Dick Allen and Ozzie Guillen. But mostly the legends of vending that are in there, everyone remembers or should remember.
So Paul went on to be a dental surgeon.
Yes, and there's several others. Well, there's one guy named John W. Rogers, Jr. His office is like across the street here at the AN Center, and he started Ariel Investments, and he was a Coke vendor. He first met him when I was selling pizza to him when he was 10. And later he became a vendor, like he's like 10 years younger than me. And somehow he met some guy named Barack Obama and became his economic advisor. And right across the streets where Obama gave his, you know, Yes We Can acceptance speech, and his headquarters were in Rogers' office at the Aerial Investments here.
And
across the street.
Doug North and Mike Morosky from our studio audience, we know we had a stripper, a male stripper, in our section, right? What was his name?
Mark Goodman.
Mark Goodman.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Well, everyone's got to hustle for a few extra bucks, but I won't do that. Yeah. I'll make the woman run out.
I think vending is one of those unique platforms or opportunities for people to, like I said, I started when I was 16. I wanted to work at Wrigley Field, be close to the Cubs. But, you know, as anybody grows up, you try to figure out what is it that you want to do with your life. I think it's great with the guys sitting around me. It's like, you know, they are working class men. They did start this and thought, this is a career. This is what I'm going to do, right? And unfortunately, things have evolved and changed. And I know a lot of people have said, well, I don't want to do this the rest of my life. My body aches. Yeah. I just feel like that there's something more that I'm supposed to do. And so people reach a certain platform to go in and do it, right? They reach a certain point where they're like, I'm done. I'm ready to move on. And some people are done for good. This is something that they did in the past, and it's something they can talk about. Others like myself, who is a teacher or, you know, an accountant or a city worker of some sort, right? It's something that's on the side, right? It's a nice thing to still be connected to Wrigley Field and all that Wrigley Field is.
And that's what you do, Bob. You're an accountant still.
Beans by day, beers by night.
But for all you guys, I mean, it's people skills. You got to have people skills to do what you do.
Well, to be good at what you do.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Certainly you have to interact with the fans. I ask almost everybody for their ID, you know, if they want a beer. And they're most of the time, you know, the 90% of them, they're so flattered because, you know, they're 40, 50 years old. Yeah. And you do find out their names and you get to talk to them and you see their ID and see where they're born, where they're from. And you make some contact, you know, and you strike up a conversation, you know, because you have, you know, at Wrigley, you still have to pour the beer. It's, I think, the only park left in the country for ball games that you still have to pour the beer.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I believe that everywhere else they give out the beer, the cans. But at Wrigley, so...
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. Wrigley, right. I think...
Go on.
I think at Wrigley, they said that they were really close to letting us give out the beer there, too. But then I think there was a couple instances of... I think in one city where people threw the cans on the field, so they said, no, we'll stick with this. But so we, you know, in the 10 seconds or 20 seconds while you're pouring the beer, you have time to talk something, you know.
That's very fair.
And there's no other guys are all businesslike, and they don't have as much rapport, you know, personal, you know, charisma with the fans. But if you spot them and talk to them, and you'll make something, they'll remember you. And buy from you again.
We're on radio, and your uncle Mike North,
mm-hmm.
radio guy,
yep.
Got you kind of suggested this. He was a vendor at one time. Where I'm going with this, Mark Carman, WGN's own Mark Carman,
that's
vendor.
Right.
Yeah,
Barry Rosner, a vendor. Yeah. I'm probably missing somebody, but why are all these vendors?
David Kaplan.
Kaplan's a vendor.
He was a vendor.
Yeah.
They were all vendors, and they got into radio.
Right.
I'm going to be a radio guy that gets into vending.
Yeah, we got a job line.
They're
bringing back taffy apples.
I'll sell cotton candy.
And taffy apples.
Yeah, right. But why is that? Is that a coincidence? Or, is it people skills?
I think it's it's an opportunity to make good money in a short amount of time. It's very unique. You know, you don't keep a schedule. You show up when you want to show up. Right. And there's no job really like that. And, you know, it's either you're here to make money or you're here to sell beer. That's what I say. And if you're here to make money, you're going to connect with fans. People like a connection. It's baseball. Right. They connect with baseball for one reason or another. And if you connect with the person, they're going to buy from you. Right. They're going to like you. They're going to want to buy from you. If you're just there to just be there and make money. Right. It's a cold transaction. Right. Mm-hmm. I just think things are different when there's a human touch to it. There's a human element, a little extra time. Goes a long way.
And you have a radio background.
I do.
CBS, producer at The Score?
I was a producer at The Score. I was a producer at the Kevin Matthews Show on 94.7 The Zone. I was in locker rooms interviewing and stuff, that sort of thing. And I was inspired by my uncle to do that. And I just realized, you know, I can't keep the lifestyle up. I can't keep that up. And I transitioned into teaching.
Yeah. But I know a little bit about, I know a lot about you, but I didn't know you did underground radio 88. 98.1 FM. What
that was my bread and butter.
What'd you do? What'd you play?
I had whatever they told me to play.
You're too young for like Jethro Tull and stuff like that.
No, I didn't have that type of show. It was more or less like anything from like the mid 80s to like the late 90s. And then I had a sports show. I had a variety show. I had a music show. I did editing. I did all that. That was fun. You know, and I wrote for the Columbia College newspaper a little bit as well. It was a lot of fun. It was my show. I kind of like you just, you know, this is what I'm good at. This is what I'm going to do. And I went and did it. And, you know, people responded well to it. And it was a lot of fun for me. Fond memories.
You know what, Doug? There's no money in radio.
I didn't want to say that. I'll be honest with you. That's why I pretty much left, because I wasn't going to go to Boise.
Is that why you never tipped me?
Okay. I didn't want to go to Boise, Idaho. You know, I love Boise, Idaho, but I didn't want to go to Boise, Idaho to their, you know, triple single A affiliate to, you know, break in there and then get shipped to, you know, wherever, Oklahoma.
It's right? Like a baseball player, like a minor league ball player.
Pretty much. Right. Or station train changes formats and like, see you later.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I loved radio. I loved connecting with people there. It was a lot of fun, but I realized that at some point in time, you know, it's not gonna treat me as I'm treating it. You know, it's gonna be gone, and I'm like, what am I going to do now?
Yeah. What a great, you know, I said this. I don't know if I can articulate it any better. It's just when I go through this book, it just takes me. You know, this book wouldn't resonate with me if it was like The Cell or anything. But it's Old Comiskey. Are they all of Old Comiskey?
No. There's a picture of Mark Carman. There's a few from the new Comiskey Park. Yeah.
But what works for me, I mean, I saw Cindy in here, and it just takes you right into the ballpark.
Right.
As you went back, Lloyd, as you went back and looked at these and put this book together, what went through your mind, and was there a couple pictures that came out to you? I know we've lost some vendors. Just emotionally, what it was like to put this together when you saw people from your past?
Well, as I look through it now, there are just so many guys that I had so much part of my life with, you know, that I had fun with, that they taught me how to, you know, to work and how to live, and they, you know, they came to my wedding, and the end of the book, there's a picture from my wedding, Abe was in there, and so it's just all of, you know, and I met my wife at the ballpark.
Yeah, how'd that, I was going to ask you that.
Well,
she was a season ticket holder.
Yeah,
I know that.
That's right, and well, turned out my brother had met her in Jamaica, and it was very, you know, 1 in 100 million chance that, but he met her on an elevator, and she found out they're both from Chicago, and then they started connecting each other. It turned out at the time I was engaged to someone else, but
wow.
Then
I didn't know he was late.
but then I broke that, my ended, and so then my brother brought up that he'd met this girl who happens to be a. Not only a baseball fan, she's a season ticket holder at White Sox Park. So this was, you know, so he gave me her number, and I called her up, and we agreed to meet at Sox Park. So I didn't actually just bump into her at Sox Park. And actually, I was working downstairs, and her seats were upstairs with her father and her brother. But, you know, we met there, and then she also loved movies like I did, and... just, you know, 1 year later, we got married pretty much.
That upper right field at Comiskey, that's where my dad took me, and that's also where I sat for Disco Demolition. You know, that's just that upper right field deck up there.
Upper left field, that's where my uncle, Mike, he got me into vending with my brother, and he had a stand in the upper deck in left field. Yeah. He was vending in the 50s.
We didn't mention one thing about the old Sox Park, that steak stand. You see the flames coming up, and they throw a little ribeye on there. They were delicious.
All righty. Well, thank you guys for coming down on a holiday weekend. It's a great segment.
Yeah, it's really, pleasure. Really.
Lloyd, just give us the details on how people can find the book.
Well, once again, you can get it from Amazon or from Barnes & Noble. A lot of Barnes & Nobles have it, or you can order it from them, and or from the Arcady Publishing, and maybe some other stores. There are other stores that probably have it, too. I know that my friend Cindy had the Rigby book at her store in Evanston, and Let's Tailgate. So other places have it that I don't even know about. They don't tell me everywhere it goes. Yeah. I'm just a writer.
Okay, thanks, you guys. Thanks for listening tonight. And you know what? We'll be back tomorrow night with A.J. Croce, Jim Croce's son. So listen in on that on WGN.